Hello and welcome to Radio XGN. It's our final episode of season two. We've been doing this a while now. I am one of your humble hosts, A.V. Eichenbaum, and with me, as per usual, is Lindsay Anderson. Lindsay, hello. Okay, so you asked me to do this AI thing, this My History deal, and I had already done the Lensa one, which we can talk about in a bit, because I have opinions, because of course I do. But, how did yours turn out?
Okay, so, if you follow me on TikTok, you may have seen, but mine just kind of reinforced this idea that I already really believed that I should not ever reproduce, because I got to see a little bit of what my ancestors might have looked like, and it, you know, they were really ugly, like, so ugly that despite the fact, like, I should be glad they're dead, because I know, like, that they were colonizers and racists and murderers. But, like, I'm also so glad they're dead because they were just that ugly. Like, they made the world a worse place by existing. One of the pictures, this isn't to diss on Trisha Paytas too much, but it does kind of remind me of Trisha Paytas' greatest hit, where she appropriated Egyptian culture, because I don't know why, but the app appropriated a lot of cultures with my face, too. But overall, I would give it a 0 out of 10. It made me, like, kind of go into a spiral. Yeah, avoid mirrors for a week because of it. So, what about yours?
Mine were pretty good. Yeah, most of mine were like, oh, here's you as a, you know, like, emperor or a pirate. We'll post some of these on Instagram, I guess. We have to, right?
If we're talking about it. Well, I can post my ugly ones, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most of these just look like me, but in different clothes.
Because you're a vampire.
They gave me some ones from, like, the punk scene as well in the 80s, which was interesting. Which it's just me with tattoos.
I've seen that picture of you.
Yeah, mine turned out great. I just look really historical. Oh no, Lindsay, buddy.
They get worse.
Jeez. We'll post some of them. You know, I did the Lensa one, which was fascinating. I've been using Lensa as an app before it could do this ability. Just to like mess around. When I get bored, sometimes I like to just like, I've been doing AI art for like a decade. I've seen it come a long way. And now people are getting upset because they're like, oh, it's stealing our art. It's stealing our art and it's putting it online and it's got your face. And I'm like, well, okay, let's address a couple of things, right? It's not stealing your art. If you put your art up online for people to look at, they can look at it and get inspired, right? So if it's perusing online for things to look at and then it's inspired by those things and it copies those things, that's not theft. That would be like me, God, Shakespeare, so cool. And then if I were to write something in iambic pentameter, that'd be like people saying, oh, you're stealing Shakespeare's work. Or like, oh, that stick figure? What a cool stick figure. I'm going to draw a stick figure of my own. That's not theft. That's inspiration. That's how art fucking works. We've been so brainwashed by the capitalist mentality surrounding art that even just saying, oh, this art kind of looks like this art is considered art theft? Fuck off.
Yeah.
All of my art, by the way, every painting I've ever done, available for free. All the music I've ever done, you can download it for free.
I was gonna say, what's your thought on, it's a quote from somebody, like, there is no such thing as original art, you know? Something that I remember from, like, a theory class I took in college, that any type of art, you know, whether it's writing, because what we do is art, storytelling, painting, is, it's just copying something that's already been done. There are no new ideas. I've never had an original thought in my life. You know, to quote Isabel, because it's not an original thought.
The funny thing about that is some postmodernist, like, angsty, chain-smoking asshole came up with that in, like, the 70s or 80s or whatever. But Plato also said the exact same thing thousands of years ago. The realm of ideal, where it's like, oh, none of our ideas are original. They come from before. They come from somewhere else. They come from a collective consciousness, and we're all absorbing it and spitting it back out. It's all sort of nebulous in a metaphysical sense. Now, that's a little woo-woo for my normal, usual pragmatism, but that's what I believe. If you're looking at it purely from the standpoint of modern art, let's look at Picasso. Was he an asshole? Yes. But, also...
Wait, was Picasso 100 years ago?
Yeah, dude.
What? Picasso, I thought he was, like, in the Renaissance.
Very recent.
What?
No, Picasso's super recent.
Oh, I mix him up with Van Gogh all the time.
Van Gogh's also not Renaissance. Anyway, so, but what Pablo Picasso said was, good artists borrow, great artists steal, right? You're going to be looking at other artists for your inspiration. Nobody creates art in a vacuum. And just because they're taking your face and applying something that they saw online to your face does not make it theft. It makes a new thing out of two other things or three other things or a billion other things. Now, the other thing is people are saying, oh, well, all of this data collection, they're going to have your face. They're going to use it to train their AI to be better. They've been doing that without your permission for decades. And when I say they, I mean social media companies. Facebook leaked a fuck ton of data less than 5 years ago.
People are always freaked out about that. You know?
You chose to be online. You chose to be online. You didn't know the risks. Now they're telling you the risks and you're upset about it. And hey, I've been working in media. Everything I've ever written professionally is online, available somewhere, and has been scanned by some bot somewhere. If they wanted to create a simulacrum of me as an AI, they have my modeling career. They've got my fucking...
They've got my modeling career.
There's a lot of photos out there of me that maybe I wouldn't... Like, I have to just not care. I have to not be embarrassed.
That's rule one of being a model.
Sure. We're getting really hung up on the fact that I was a model for a year. I also worked at McDonald's at the same time, okay? It was a side gig. Look, life is not glamorous. You gotta do what you gotta do to get by.
Do you want to know another crazy theory? Just before we go into the news?
Yeah, okay.
About the McRib, because you reminded me. Okay, so you know how we have, like, so much media out this year and kind of recently about cannibalism? You know, there's, like, the new Timothée Chalamet movie about cannibalism, and there's been, like, all the Dahmer stuff.
Yeah, everything that I love and adore.
Yeah, sure. So this one, like, person on the internet was like, they're releasing this to normalize cannibalism because in the next couple of years, we're going to find out that the McRib has traces of human flesh in it and that Americans have just been eating... human, and so they want us to be okay with it.
Have you ever read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle?
Is that the one where the guy, like, hunts people?
No.
Oh, then no.
It's about the food industry 100 years ago. Upton Sinclair is one of the greatest journalists of the last 100 years, by the way. And it's about food processing.
Were people eating people?
And it's the reason we have an FDA now, partially. But there's also, fun fact... a limit to the amount of spiders that you can have in a chocolate bar and it still be safe.
What's the limit?
I think it's like 8 spiders.
This is very important for the rest of my life. Oh my God.
Yeah, I think that's, don't quote me on that, but like there is a limit to the amount of safety of like non-chocolate food that you can have in chocolate before you throw it out, right? So here's the thing about literally anything. If you look deep enough, it's problematic. There is not a single pure thing on this earth.
Anyways, the news!
We have a great interview coming up for you. The show is Death and Friends. You'll hear all about it after these messages.
Gotta do the self-care.
How are you? Still a little low?
Well, therapy's been good, but it might be smart to lock up the oxy from your surgery.
Are you worried?
Well, I know not to take medication that's not mine, but I don't want to have it around on a hard day.
I'll lock it up.
That's very caring.
That's me, self-caring for everyone.
Protect the ones you love from opioid misuse. Lock up your medication.
Win some, meet at Ryan House every Monday night from 7 to 8:30. Join us for Monday Night Football and Meat Raffle Monday. Enjoy happy hour beer and wine while watching football and plan to win some homemade sausages, selected cuts of meat, Ryan House swag, gift cards, and more. There's two winners every half hour. Remember, Ryan House has a heated and covered patio, saving your beer and brats where the air is fresh and the space is warm. So come and get your meat.
Joining me today via Zoom is two people I'm very excited for y'all to meet. It's the hosts of Death and Friends, which I've mentioned on the show before. If you haven't listened to it, you should. It gets bleak in the best of ways. It makes all the difference in the world. Please welcome Nash Flynn and Angel Luna. Folks, hello. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're excited to be here.
How would you describe your show to folks? How do you pitch it? What's going on here?
I mean, I think we always like to say it's not a history podcast that's funny, and it's also not a comedy podcast about history. It's somewhere in both places, but bad in both places, I think. Yeah. We're the Venn diagram of not driving. We're not very good business people. Our producer is absolutely melting right now.
Yeah, it's we're just having a good old time, just having the worst time.
You go back through history and you look at a bunch of folks that died, which happens a lot.
It does, yeah.
Just
what a way to describe that.
Do you have favorite episodes that you've covered?
I think all of them are really fun in the moment, but we've had a blast. We're writing one right now that I don't want to spoil too much, but it's going to have a lot of songs.
Yeah. Yes, it will.
I think we try to challenge ourselves every season to tackle something that we shouldn't do. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
definitely
a topic where we're like, we're not qualified to talk about this. We should not establish this as historians and comedians. We really aren't good singers, so we should do some singing this season.
We should definitely sing this season. Yeah, that's kind of the mentality behind it. It's it's awful. Yeah.
You do have a lot of jingles in your show.
Yeah, we do,
which is what gave us the false confidence to really go for it this season.
Our sound editor is too good, and he really fills it in, you know what I mean?
He really does. It's a shame we kill him every episode.
Yeah, we really should stop doing that. But I mean, I think to answer your question, Salem Witch Trials was one of my absolute favorites. I think the Emu War was also a really fun one just to do, because we weren't approaching it as like, this is a normal episode. We were like, we are going to have more fun than we do history on the Emu War episode. So I remember that one being really fun. But I think, unfortunately, I say unfortunately not because it was truly unfortunate, but because of the subject matter, I think my favorite one is the Thanksgiving episode in season one. And part of the reason that I like it is it's where my historical expertise is. But part of the reason I also like listening to it is because I was so nervous about presenting the subject matter in a way that does Indigenous history correctly that I got way too high before we recorded. And
it's
I had
a lot
to struggle.
If you've ever been in a recording session, that's saying a lot.
It's saying a lot. I have the worst like red light anxiety, so I was so anxious about that subject matter and doing it properly. As Angel put it once, I had to like get ready to deliver a line and then I would like sort of power down.
For sure.
It took 8 hours to do that episode.
Yeah, we're still doing it now, actually.
Some say we're still working on it now. I really love the vampires episode, just because I feel like that's the episode where we really started finding our groove as a show. Just like, okay, we do like doing these dumb, silly bits that recur all the time.
Yeah.
We start using music cues more, stuff like that. Just, you know, that's a really fun episode. I think a fan favorite episode that we reference a lot is our second episode ever, the King Tut episode, or is that the third episode?
It's our worst episode.
It's
absolutely
our worst episode.
Hands
it
down.
Is
we're
not
proud
good.
Of it.
I
we're
love
not
that
proud
episode.
Of it. But people keep bringing it up, and we're just like, okay. And like, it's funny because I'm currently working on like this cool edit to promo the next season, and we went to a King Tut exhibit, and the whole time we're like, it's Lord Carnarvon, and it's, oh my gosh, and like we had too much fun, just too much fun.
I think that's the problem. It really was an episode where we stretched the comedy line too far in one direction. And I do think it's one of those episodes that we look back on very, very fondly as comedians. But as historians, it kind of makes us die inside.
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah.
Yeah. We were not nice people when we recorded that episode. Yeah.
Do you think you'll ever do like a King Tut redux?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. There's definitely been a few episodes where we listen back and we're like, yes, we're going to do this again, right?
Yeah.
For sure.
Just because, you know, it takes a lot of work to make these episodes happen and to write them out. And sometimes time is not kind to us, nor our editor. So
nor ADHD. Also a factor.
Also, there's not enough weed to get high off of. And like, there's just a multitude of factors, right? And so there's a few episodes where like, this could have been better. And like, after the fact, you know, just like you would do it, like any artist goes through anything, they're like, oh, this could have been so much better. So there's going to be a lot of those kind of episodes. But I think those are going to come like much later on.
For sure.
We'll get like the Taylor's version once we redo them.
Exactly.
Just going to be monsters on the hill for everybody to see, huh?
Exactly.
Yes. And you'll feel just as bad after you listen to it.
Mm-hmm. How did this come about? How did you guys get started with the show?
Here, I'll tell the story because my version is correct. So me and Nash met on the crossroads in the Gothic South. Now, I had met Nat. Was it a Zoom show first, or was it like a writing session?
I think it was a writing session.
Like, yeah, we had met like over a comedian Zoom writing session thing. And we just clicked, like we immediately became friends. And Nash, after asking about 10 other comedians first.
No, incorrect.
after literally begging and pleading with multiple mutual acquaintances.
No.
She was like, hey, like just very like, do you want to do a show, I guess? I tried everything. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'd love to. And then that's it. No, in actuality, Nash one day was like, hey, I have a pitch. Do you want to hear it? And I was like, yeah, sure. Let's hear it. And like, it was Death and Friends. And I was like, wow, that sounds pretty cool. Yeah. Who are you going to do it with? I was just like, do you want to do it? I was like, I would love to do it.
It was so funny though, because I don't know if this was clear. I have ADHD. I've mentioned that several times already. Mm-hmm. We're 10 minutes in. For sure. It's my personality. It's all I have left. But I love starting projects. I have big ideas. I love the, like the excitement of being like, I'm going to start a thing. And then I buy all the things that I need to start that thing. And then I never start it at all. I have a collection of hobbies that I've never begun that litter my house.
Can verify.
And so we were in the middle of the pandemic. Every single comedian I knew had started a podcast. And I was like, how do I market myself as a podcaster while I'm being different than everyone else that's doing podcasts? That's just comedians sort of talking about local events or whatever, comedy. And then I was like, oh wait, I went to school for death. There has to be something there. So then I called up the creepiest person that I could think of. My yep. dad. No, I'm just kidding.
Yep, there it is. Yeah, I mean, me and Nash, we lean towards the creepier side of things, mm-hmm. just in general, like aesthetic. I'm recording from a cave, an actual cave.
Yeah. He's allergic to the sun.
I'm allergic to the sun. That's why I love vampires so much.
Out of curiosity, what did you study specifically about death? Because my plan before I had to drop out and do this was I was getting a master's in thanatology.
Oh, cool.
Death lore. Yeah.
Thank you so much for explaining what that is.
No worries. I have to do it a lot.
It's basically like Deathways before Deathways existed.
No, please, Nash, mansplain AV's
Sorry. Job. I will.
As they were explaining it to us.
Just explain stuff to me. I need it. I'm a journalist. We're dumb. We're just, journalism's wild because it is just me going over here and saying, hey, what's going on? And then I write about it, and that's the whole thing. That's
right,
it.
But like, well, you have a soothing voice and you're good at it. So.
Oh, well.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good thing that you're interviewing comedians because comedians are very, very smart people. We know what we're doing.
Excellent. Thank you.
At all
We're
things.
Brave.
Yeah.
So courageous.
And you know what? We're really good at getting slapped in the face and just moving right along. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's something you have to like learn.
The most money we've ever made based off of that.
Just yeah. always.
Yeah. Meanwhile, it's a real journalists, weird fetish. You know, we're really thin-skinned, impossibly thin-skinned. Yes. It's terrifying.
Yeah, yes. God, the absolute worst.
The gall. Sorry. I did ask a question, though.
Yeah, what? No, you're good. So specifically, I studied gravestone iconography. It gets nicher than that, honest to God. Mm-hmm. But we can funnel down the chain if you're interested. But I did my master's on studying gravestone iconographic trends to measure changes in cultural beliefs about death. So I focused specifically in the 17th century in New England, looking at Burial Hill in Plymouth and sort of using how the carvers approached art on gravestones as a measure for what was changing in the beliefs and approaches to death. So when we arrive in very early 17th century, we colonize, whatever term you're comfortable with. Colonize is probably the correct one, but mm-hmm. we arrive on shore and then there's a little bit of interaction between the indigenous people in the area. And that does change death rites on both sides. So that's what we mean when we say death ways is this whole branching cultural practice around death itself. So the rites, the rituals, but also how those rites and rituals are affected by cross contact, either by genocide or by war or by sheer landscape. how those collaborations are affected. So Deathways describes that whole process. In Deathways, I'm very specific to tangible artifacts. So I fall somewhere in between archaeology and anthropology in terms of discipline. So it's a really interesting field because for Deathways, you sort of have to straddle at least one or two of those areas mm-hmm. in order to get a good enough picture of what death is looking like.
And I am also here.
He loves that line.
How does that translate to comedy over time for both of you? Like, how does that interact? Like, does it change the writing process at all that you have facts and then the grim reality is that, I mean, everything's funny because it's sad because it's true, I guess. Mm-hmm. But,
right.
but how does the process work there?
I've always found that you kind of nailed it, right? It's sad and it's funny and it's true. That helps a lot. but like a lot of history, when you look at it on the modern lens, is objectively hilarious, because a lot of the motives behind some things are just absolutely ridiculous. So like, you know, the Caesar having a French lady who just poisons people when they do them wrong is the funniest thing in the world to me. Just absolute little kid, like not getting what he wants shit, you know, stuff like that. And like a lot of the time, I would argue we were very left-leaning. We say no to capitalism. We hate racism, obviously, you know, all the bad isms, we hate them. And so how do you take power away from those things? You make fun of them. And so that's the way I approach it, you know. And we do have like our guidelines and our metrics that we have written out when we write an episode now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of it's like, how do we punch up, make this palatable, and also just entertain our dumbass brains?
And one of the things we try to do when we pick these narratives is to think about where death is changing the most in history. Now, I know it's a comedy show. It feels very much like a comedy show. We are idiots. But there is sometimes a thought process behind what's happening academically with the show. And the seasons are all sort of interconnected in a way that might not seem incredibly obvious until we start getting into some of the later seasons. So one of the things we try to do is pick stories that either showcase an interesting part of death or an interesting way to die, and then find pieces about those that are inherently amusing, even if they're very sad or brutal in a lot of ways. There is always somebody fucking up somewhere or doing something that they shouldn't be doing or being somewhere that they shouldn't be, that makes it easy to be like, this is our fall guy. Every time I think about how we create those episodes, I think about Arthur Gell and the story of the Boston Molasses Flood, because that guy, he fucked up from start to finish. It really is like horrible. People died. Nobody talks about it. But Arthur Gell, he really just, he biffed it from the beginning to the end.
An actual idiot running the plant. Like if there was ever an argument against nepotism,
it's
Arthur Gell and then The Godfather Part 3. Like those are the two reasons.
And Donald Trump.
Yeah, 100%.
I've been jumping around listening to the show, but white guy three names keeps happening. Can we talk about that? Where did that?
Was that a riff originally? I want to say, so to give you an idea of how the episode's episode's written, we write a draft, we cold read it, we write jokes towards it, and then, you know, we might do another dry run or we might just record. And a lot of the times we'll riff in a dry run and we're like, oh, put that in. But if the riff is really good, we remember it. And I think White Guy Three Names was a riff, if I remember that correctly.
Yeah, I don't remember from when, but I want to say it was the Helen Jewett episode where
I want to say that was that too, because we kept noticing like, what is it with these white dudes and having three names?
The more money and the more white you are, the more names you have.
Yeah,
for whatever reason,
because you can afford the letters to put on your tombstone. Yeah. And so that's where we were at. And then eventually the jingle came. I was like, we should have a jingle for this because it's a recurring bit at this point.
Yeah.
And the jingles happen. And it's funny because it's our editor, Dom, who does that song. And we're like, hey, we need you to sing this jingle. And I remember he asked me, he's like, what do you want for this? I'm like, the most off key, just awful. Yep.
We want it to be shitty. Like,
No. We want it to be just as shitty as these men. He's like, got it. Understood. And now we have that jingle. White guy. Yeah.
It's so good, but terrible.
I am a white guy three names, so it cracks me up to no end. Put us in our place, honestly. It's the
oh, just based on this last name, I would make so much fun of you. Yeah. Eichenbaum, yes, of course.
Yes, Asher.
Gentlemen, Eichenbaum. Yeah. Too evil. Like
exactly. Technically, I'm a count. It doesn't matter.
Okay. Honest though, you have big count vibes. Like you're bringing count right now.
Yeah, it's giving. Count.
Just serving count right and left.
The only count I've ever served in my life is Chocula. So
I saw it coming from a mile away.
Thank you.
I was
thank
like, this man's about to make a
thank you very much, Chocula. Oh, thank you.
Is there anything that you guys would like our listeners specifically to know about you or the show before we head out today?
Season 4 was supposed to come out in January, but it's probably going to be late. I'm really sorry.
Can't verify honest to God. That. Yeah, I think something that happens for anybody who's a listener of ours or like is wanting to be a listener, it's a little tricky to write a show that takes this much time, because as silly and as, you know, crass as it is, we try very, very hard to be historically accurate, like disgustingly hard.
It's hours of research every single episode.
Every single time. even with like a silly creature feature that we do, which is like an episode about like a mythical creature or something, those take hours, those take days sometimes. And so, you know, they take a while, but it's not that we're just stopping and starting. Like, life happens and that can be a little tricky sometimes, but you know, we put a lot of ourselves in this series just because we love it so much. I know for me personally, you know, I don't know where I'd be without Death and Friends, just on a personal level. The show kept me sane when I had to move back to a faraway, awful land known as Texas. It kept me sane just during some hard times. And I've been blessed to where a lot of folks reach out to me, like on Instagram and Twitter, and they're like, hey, I love the show, and it means so much to me. And, you know, I often read like paragraphs of like, the show means so much because of XYZ. And like, you know, it's that meme of like, why are you crying so hard? And like, it's like, you know, I've met really cool people and I love the fan base that we've made. And I just hope that anybody in the fan base that's listening to this knows that, you know, we mean it at the end of each episode. We do want to be your friend. And like, you know, it's hard out here for a pimp.
It is. It is. I can attest.
Yeah. Nash can definitely attest. So that's my cheesy spiel, Nash.
I was going to say something less cheesy and honestly, like, worse than that. I was just going to say, you know, we've had the unfortunate luck in the off seasons of having really just like hard times for whatever reason. And it's weird for me as somebody who professionally studies death, that people in my life die. Like, I think that's pretty rude. Like, I don't want to work on the weekends, but they do that. So we've been dealing with that this week. Yeah. And it is interesting looking at our show now and then thinking about how grief happens in real life. And thinking about the two ways that those intersect, you know, I was at the hotel between the wake and the funeral writing the Death and Friends episode and being like, this is sort of fucked up in a new way that I don't want to tell my therapist about, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I know that when my grandfather died during COVID, it was like during the ramp up of like getting Death and Friends going. And I was just like, this is weird. Why am I doing this now? Yes. Should I be like, so can verify. It is a little weird.
Yeah.
As a fan of the show and as someone who, I started as a crime journalist at age 14. Wow. Yeah, it's a whole thing. I'm 27 now. I've been doing this 13 years. And I've lost a lot of people. And that was part of why I went into studying death. And your show does that for your fans. So, you know, thank you for doing that. I just, you know, it's been really great to meet y'all. And where can we find you online?
Should we just do the sign off, Nash?
No.
You can follow Death and Friends Podcast at Death and Friends Podcast on Instagram. You can follow me at Gorilla Jokes. That's GUERRILLA Jokes.
And I am everywhere at It's Nash Flynn. That includes Venmo, by the way. I don't know how much longer it's going to include Twitter. I don't.
Yeah, that's why I just said Instagram. Follow us there, just because who knows on that hell site anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's me and Elon Musk's bots now. Just us hanging out.
And obviously we have a Patreon, patreon.com/Death and Friends Podcast. And I think it's just Death and Friends, sorry. And we have a website where deathandfriends.org. It's great.
And that'll all be in the show notes. Again, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
And we're back. All right. Brittany Griner in the news, freed in U.S. hands. People are upset because, of course, they are about everything.
Wait, why are people upset? I'm sorry. I missed this part.
Oh, man. Well, she was traded for a Russian arms dealer who's a former Soviet lieutenant and is known as the Merchant of Death. And people are saying we got a bad deal. Arguably, maybe we did. There's another guy, Paul Whelan, that's still stuck in Russia. Originally, the trade was going to be this arms dealer for both of them. The U.S. has been very open about its negotiations, which Russia has not enjoyed. Mm. And I did write this piece, so I got to do a lot of research on it. I've been following this thing pretty seriously. I'm a big WNBA fan. Mm-hmm. So, her wife is thrilled, and Biden, the Whelan family, is disappointed, but knows that there was nothing they could do. It was either get one person or get none. And because this business executive, who's a security business executive named Paul Whelan, has been there since 2018. He's been wrongfully detained on espionage charges. They're treating it different than the, quote, smuggling charges that Griner was accused of. Now, here's the thing. Griner was not smuggling. She had some vape canisters that were less than a gram of cannabis oil in her bag at a Russian airport, right? So they blew this out of proportion. In my piece, I called it a histrionic response. Ooh, because it's overdramatic, it's over the top, and it's classic
Russia.
It's almost Cold War tactics.
Well, but don't you think that her identity as a queer woman also plays a big role in why she was detained?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But I'm saying that the charges were made up,
yeah,
and they were ridiculous and overwrought. She's an American, black, queer, all-star athlete, and she's a woman, and none of that is good in Russia. I'm surprised she made it out, if I'm being completely honest. She was in, I think it's called IK2, which is the harshest penal colony in Russia. She had just been moved there this week.
I mean, good on Biden for getting her out.
Yeah.
It makes me upset that there are people that are upset about this, you know, because it's like, I feel like human life is important regardless of who it is. You know, you shouldn't say that she's less important or more important than this other person that also needs to be gotten out of Russian prison. But her identities, I think, put her at a greater risk because of the prejudices that, you know, we know that Russian police hold against queer people and women of color. Like you said, she was put in one of the harshest prisons. You're right, it is amazing that she got out.
I mean, it's classic tactics just to, like, blow something out of proportion, make Biden look bad in the eyes of moderates and right-wing folk, and try to get someone else in there that's more sympathetic.
I think he should be looking pretty good at this, though.
He looks good to his base. I think he got a raw deal. I'm glad that it happened, but it's very obvious that they were hoping for both of them and it didn't work out.
Yeah.
Right, it's not a victory. It's a step forward, especially because the Russian-Ukraine conflict is still happening. The war is still happening. We haven't been talking about it, but like, people are still fighting in Kyiv.
Yeah,
the U.S. had to run it by Ukraine to be like, "Hey, is this okay?" And they got the go-ahead to even begin negotiations. Look, it's not pretty, but it's what we got. And the fact that it was Griner and not Whelan, who's been there, again, since 2018, people are going to be mad either way, right?
Well, I mean, if you're asking pro-lifers, they should be happy, right?
The logical jump you made there.
I mean, because it's pro-life. Biden saved a life.
We can't even joke about that anymore. Pro-lifers are not pro-life after birth. Everyone knows that. They're aware of it. It's, you know, we can't even make that as a crack because people will think we're misinterpreting what they actually stand for, which is pro-gestation, maybe?
Anti-women.
Anti-women, anti-fem-bodied people. If they were really pro-life, they'd be anti-pollution.
Yeah, or pro-rescuing Brittany Griner.
Right. On the silver lining here is that Griner is back, and honestly, nobody should be kept in prisons. Prisons should be abolished, or at least rehabilitated to the point where they're genuinely helpful and not what we have today.
Yeah.
It's not a bright side necessarily, but a lot more people have been talking about incarceration, and a lot more people have been talking about getting people home, getting people back to the States, which is in itself a shit show. So, hey, members of the WNBA have been, you know, lauding her for her courage and her accomplishment. It's not an accomplishment, it's trauma. And she's going to have a lot to work through, and I hope she recovers from this, because she's such a strong spirit. But her wife has announced that they're going to be continuing to support bringing prisoners home from abroad in every way they can. BG is free, and we should be happy about it. And Paul Whelan's going to be coming home soon, we hope. What do you want to talk about today, Lindsay?
I would love to talk about queerbaiting, if you don't mind.
Let's do it, because I've had thoughts on this, and I'm glad that Georgia offered up this pitch. I don't think that individuals should be accused of queerbaiting. I think that corporations should be, and I think that people who represent corporate entities should be.
Yeah, this actually reminds me of a conversation that was going on around the new Netflix show Wednesday, which has actually now become the, like, most streamed in its debut week Netflix series ever, like, surpassed Stranger Things. Have you followed it?
I haven't watched it because I've been busy.
You know, to each one's own, people have a lot of opinions about it. But one opinion that I've seen on Twitter was that they were queer baiting because before the show came out, Netflix was releasing a lot of promotions that were kind of like shipping Wednesday with one of her like female friends. And it wasn't just them like liking posts that were doing this because, you know, like fans will often queer ship same-sex platonic relationships. But this was Netflix. They were saying things like girlfriends or there's just other vernacular that tends to be used by the queer community that led many to believe that this would be either bisexual representation or, you know, some kind of a queer representation.
Okay.
And Wednesday herself has been often interpreted by fans to be queer coded.
Mm-hmm. And autistic coded, by the by. Shout out.
You definitely know, represent. Yes. But when the show came out, they had like no queer characters. Both Wednesday and Enid, the female character that they had kind of like hinted at might have a relationship, both were in like different love triangles with men.
Okay.
Where they were the singular female in these love triangles. So a lot of people have come forward to like accuse Netflix of queer baiting.
But let's talk about Georgia's stance on this and about the weaponization of queer baiting, because that, how does that tie in?
Yes, yeah, so this ties in where Georgia brought up the treatment of Kit Connor, who was also starred in a Netflix series, who faced similar Twitter backlash for queer baiting because he portrayed a role that was a bisexual character in a show and hadn't publicly come out as any kind of a member of the LGBTQ community, and then was spotted with a female co-star on a date. And so people immediately started to try to cancel him for queer baiting by making fans maybe believe that he was queer when now they started to think he wasn't. And so then he was forced to come out as bisexual, you know, before he was ready to, and nobody should be forced to publicly out themselves at all.
We talked about something similar with the kid from Heartstopper, right?
That is the kid from Heartstopper.
Okay, so it's the same shit. This is a singularly Gen Z conundrum. This is the most Gen Z thing I've ever heard, and I get to shit on you guys for a second now, being on the cusp, having seen both sides. We had Tumblr, but y'all are so quick to get angry at people for not exactly lining up in the exact box that you think that they should based on their subgenre on your fucking social media page, and it makes me irate, because I fought for years against already preset stereotypes about gender, about Jewishness, race, about everything, queerness in my own personal life. And we have had activists for generations do the same thing. And I feel that Gen Z, because people aren't conforming to their idea of what those things should be, are making the world worse by trying to put people in their box and attacking them for not fitting those boxes, which is like the opposite of what you should be doing. There we go. That's my very negative
take. I hear what you're saying. I totally agree.
Finally, after 2 years of this, I'm biting back.
I think that Gen Z isn't the only group of people that do this. And as Georgia writes in her piece, it is a very nuanced conversation to have because on one hand, you do want authentic representation. You know, there was a lot of pushback when Eddie Redmayne, for instance, you know, played a trans woman as a cis man. We've had other instances of like heterosexual people playing queer characters, like in Modern Family. You know, one of the men in the gay couple on Modern Family is actually a straight actor. So it's the conversation of like, are straight cis people taking away roles and opportunities from people in the LGBTQ community that have struggled historically in roles in Hollywood? And so I think that there are still straight people taking roles from queer people to this day. And again, there's the same thing of Harry Styles, where he's not out as queer, but he benefits from certain things that somebody that is out as queer, like Lil Nas X, gets a lot of hate for. You know, Lil Nas X dresses and transcends gender roles, will wear dresses on the red carpet, and has so much hate that he gets from especially conservatives and trolls on the internet that just seems to not touch when people aren't out as queer. And Georgia talks about the reason why people wouldn't be out as queer is because it is definitely very dangerous in this time, especially when we've seen, you know, people losing their lives because of the identities that they hold. But at the same time, it is a back and forth of wanting to see people that hold these identities, represent the characters that hold these identities, and then at the same time not wanting to force somebody to have to come out before they're ready, and just kind of, I don't know, having faith in the people that we see on our screens that they are making the right decision now. But yeah, after years of seeing the wrong decisions be made, I think that people are quick to assume that if somebody isn't publicly out, that they are straight and cis.
It is safer than it has been ever before to come out, even if it is still scary in certain places, especially in the US. In a world where we look at these stereotypes and these ways of being and make decisions based on, I don't know, a 30-second video and just a string of other people telling us how it is supposed to be, we did this already. Millennials have already done this. I've already seen this happen, and we all decided it was a bad idea because Tumblr existed, DeviantArt existed, MySpace. People like to think that MySpace was not toxic social media. It super was. We've already cyberbullied everyone into submission, and then we decided, oh shit, we were being assholes. And now I'm looking back and seeing everybody else do it. But on a public scale, because there's so many more people with phones and so many more people screaming into the ether, that celebrity or not, people are accusing cousins, friends, family of queerbaiting. That's insane.
Yeah, I think it comes back to this conversation that we had a while ago, too, on fashion queerbaiting. You know, we talked about how there historically has been, especially for queer women, you know, styles that indicate or give a nod to queerness without having to explicitly, you know, have the lesbian flag as a cape, that have recently become more fashionable and appropriated by straight people. And then it, you know, you mentioned your friend that, you know, hit on a straight woman at the bar, and that people will, you know, go, oh no, I'm not gay, but it's like, well, you look gay, you know? And it's kind of this same idea of, I think that straight people can take and appreciate and wear queer fashions and fashions that have been made popular by queer people, but you need to have an understanding of the message that you're sending with what you choose to wear. And yeah, maybe not cancel your cousins and your sisters and your brothers if they are dressing queer as a cis or straight person, but as a cis straight person, if you are going to wear something that does send a message, that you shouldn't be, I don't know, embarrassed or repulsed when queer people assume that you're one of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I feel like people should be able to do what they want as long as it's not hurting anybody.
Yeah.
And if they're gonna be assholes about it when someone hits on them because they look fucking cute, don't fucking mm-hmm. do it. People make me so fucking angry. I guess that's what it comes down to. Literally everybody is pointing fingers because everyone thinks that they're right. And in reality, nobody knows anything. Nobody knows shit. We're all just bumbling around trying to make life work for ourselves. And the least we can do is have some common fucking decency and not scream at one another for no reason.
Yeah, that is definitely fair.
I think that's what it comes down mm-hmm. to. That's where my anger comes from. I hate bullies.
The problem is that it's never as black and white as somebody is a bully. You know, someone may see, I feel like for the queer community especially, if you are somebody that has been constantly attacked for your identity, then you will see straight people as bullies.
But do you know who else uses that argument?
Marginalized people of color.
Nazis. Marginalized people of color use that argument.
Women.
Literally anyone who perceives themselves as oppressed. And there are people who are actually oppressed, like the two groups you just mentioned.
And the LGBTQ community is a group of people that are oppressed.
It is. But there's also people who use the same rhetoric that you just said to enact violence when they don't mm-hmm. deserve to take victimhood onto themselves. And there's also people that decide that they're going to stand up for the LGBTQ community that maybe shouldn't be fucking talking. Who's really getting angry? Because all we see are tweets. We don't know these people.
Yeah.
All we see is the backlash. We don't see who started it. We don't see the history of it. All we're doing is working ourselves up into mob mentality over, oh, this guy's holding hands with a girl. And people just blindly follow whoever's the angriest.
The experience with Kit Connor, too, I think is, aside from it being an example of, you know, people going too far with their ideas on what queerbaiting is, it's also biphobia, because I think that a lot of people forget that bisexual people exist and that you can be queer and also hold hands with somebody that is the opposite sex, and that's not outing you as straight, you know?
Yeah, and we're recording, it's Pansexual Awareness Week. Shout out to all the pansexual folks out there listening to our show. I know we have quite a few.
We appreciate all of you.
You are valid. All the non-binary folks represent, all the gender fluid folks. There is, again, an image that people are saying we should force ourselves into that causes this mob mentality, and it's just not accurate. And all the while, it's those people that get the angriest about people not fitting into their box are the same people that are like, oh, well, we have to be so accepting of this. We have to, like, where does the intolerance stop? And that's how you get fucking Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. We're out of time, folks.
Yeah, I guess the message in this podcast is, where would you want to wear? Hold hands with whoever you want to hold hands with. Don't let the haters get you down. Fuck Netflix because they do queer bait. And don't attack individuals because people are complex and complicated and they don't owe you explanations for their actions when they are loving, like holding hands.
Tear down systems, not each other.
Yes.
We'll see you guys in the new year. And we'll see you in the funny pages.
Happy New Year.
I did not expect to get that emotional. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
All right.
Radio SGN is hosted by A.V. Eichenbaum and Lindsay Anderson and produced by A.V. Eichenbaum. Music for this show was provided by T.R.G. Banks and Jesse Spillane, or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org or wherever you find podcasts.